Well, this is a pretty auspicious week, Porky, because we've just had Bonfire Night.
Yep.
We've just had Halloween.
Yep.
We went to see The Exorcist this week, as we said in episode 26. We're now on episode 27.
We are.
So we're going to move on to other matters, are we not?
You haven't forgotten about the most important event.
What's that?
Everton get 3 points.
I'm not mentioning that.
No, okay.
This is not a sports podcast.
It's not a sports podcast, but it's part of my life, and it dictates my mood.
Oh, does that mean you're in a good mood for a change?
I'm in a good mood, yeah.
So you've been in a bad mood for about 6 months.
Well, why do you think that is?
Yeah. Well, exactly. Because Everton have been awful.
Yeah, well, they're not now.
It's only a home win against Watford, by the way.
I don't care.
And they've only leapt up the table to number 15.
Don't care.
So I really don't think it's time for sort of premature enjoyment.
You don't know what it's like to be in love with
something
like
Everton. You don't know what it's like.
Well, that's right, yeah.
I'm going to start singing over you now because you've been doing it to me for so long that I've decided I'm going to just burst into song from time to time.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't if I were you because it'll just drive people mad.
No, people like my voice, actually.
Now, listen, very sadly, I read about the death of a veteran Fleet Street journalist again today.
One of the
journals that I read.
Okay.
And it's of no consequence who he was, but it reminded me that a lot of the people I work with in Fleet Street are not around anymore.
Yes.
And this guy was a diarist.
Well,
now,
I mean, I'm not going to be sort of churlish here, but I mean, it is of some consequence, particularly to maybe people that knew him.
Yes.
Is it anyone that I knew?
No, it's not really. I didn't even know him either. So, but it was said he worked on this diary and that diary. I think he was a bit of a journeyman.
Okay.
But I mean, it reminded me that I worked with the greatest diarist that ever been in Fleet Street, including Nigel Dempster.
Yes.
And Nigel was a great guy because he took himself so seriously.
He did.
And he invented, actually, the diary of those days. He was literally the guy who stayed out in nightclubs till 3 o'clock in the morning, and then 2 days later, the stories he picked up there would appear in his the Nigel Dempster diary.
He also knew everybody that was worth knowing.
He did, yeah.
If Dempster didn't know him, they weren't worth knowing.
No, that's absolutely right.
As far as society was concerned.
He broke some great stories. One of the stories he broke, which I got involved in, was Robert Sangster, the racehorse trainer, and he met one of his people in a nightclub in London, had suddenly become the boyfriend of Jerry Hall, the singer, who was at the time the girlfriend of Mick Jagger.
Right.
But Mick Jagger would not betroth himself to her.
Yeah.
So she said, I've had enough. The multimillionaire horse racing trainer, Robert Sangster, along. Next thing you know, they're off to the Cayman Islands
He's
or something.
Riding off into the sunset.
Yeah. And he broke this. So it's fantastic. It made the front page splash in the mail.
Yeah.
Often, you know, Nigel would talk to people who are so important, they bounced out of his diary.
Yeah.
And he used to get furious because he said, you can't have that for your front page.
Yeah, exactly.
I want that for my diary.
I'd have to find another lead. Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, all diarists were like that. They never quite understood,
you
know, because their main sort of purpose in life was to go out and drink.
That's right.
And, I mean, the writing of the diary was almost incidental to their job because they had to go to lots of parties and they wanted to go as early as possible out of the office. So when the back bench, which was the like, production centre of the newspaper, or the editor, would come and say, right, we're taking that story, they'd have to find another one.
Yeah, they would.
And,
yeah.
I mean, they didn't like doing it.
Yeah, that's right. No, that's absolutely right. And do you know what? These diarists, I mean, they mixed with such a collection of people, you know, with lords, with aristocrats, with crooks.
And rock stars, of course,
and rock
as you
stars.
Say.
Remember John, was it John Bindon, the guy who was a crook?
Bindon, that's right.
And
bank robber, wasn't he?
He was a bank robber. He was also involved in a situation where he got knifed and killed somebody, I think, in retaliation and got off with the murder charge.
Yep.
But he was going out with Vicky Hodge, the actress. So she was on the phone every day to old Dempster or our very own Ross Benson.
When the Express had William Hickey,
who was, of course,
a fictitious character.
That's right. Yeah. But you know, John Bindon, I mean, he ended up on Mystique with Princess Margaret.
Right.
Another, you know, diary collective type place.
But isn't that kind of the way the society evolved, you know, that what we call high society in the sort of in the 70s, really, because it was rock stars, as you say, you know, drug dealers.
Absolutely.
Like, you know, the guy, what was his name? The guy that was constantly going on about legalising cannabis.
Oh, yeah, Mr. Nice.
Mr. Nice,
yes,
that's right,
yeah.
There was him, there was, you know, the whole Rolling Stones.
He was
Stone
an Oxford
set.
Graduate, you know.
That's right.
Started
yeah.
making money at Oxford on the side by peddling a bit of cannabis.
Yeah.
Became the world's biggest dealer in cannabis.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, he would be.
What's his name? Howard.
Howard Marks.
Howard Marks.
He would be as often as not in the Dempster diary
would,
as Princess Margaret would
he
be.
He would,
you know, and
would.
It was that kind of notorious thing. It was almost like the Andy Warhol famous for 15 minutes.
That's right.
If you get into Tramp, basically you get into the diary.
That's right. And models would go
George
in
George Best was in there.
Of course he was, all the time.
Footballers, you know, Rodney Marsh probably.
Yeah, that's right. You know John Bindon's party trick?
Yeah.
Especially with women.
Right.
When his...
Was it rude?
It is rude, yes.
I think I've heard this, but remind
but
me.
But this is OTR, it's adult.
Yeah, try and keep it relatively
When
clean.
His member was erect, he could actually put six half-pint... beer jugs.
No.
One on top of the other with the handles.
Say, I was going to say, hopefully not one next to each other.
No, with the handles hanging off his member.
Really?
And walked around the room.
No.
Yes.
That's very long.
Well, that was his
really?
Party trick. Yeah, that's what he could do.
Blimey.
Yeah.
You sure it wasn't a demi-tasse?
No. And that was what he was famous for. But
he's quite well endowed, in other words.
He was very well endowed, apparently. Yeah. How would I know? But apparently he was.
Yeah.
Now, the other thing is, these diarists, right, they had their favourite sort of snouts, if you see what I mean.
Yes.
And often the snouts were on the periphery of royalty or something like that, or the periphery of wealthy families, but had nothing themselves.
Yeah.
So they're always ringing up Ross or Nigel Dempster, telling them stories, and needing a 50 quid.
Yeah.
And one of the worst was Di Llewellyn. Do you remember him?
That's right, Di Llewellyn. Yeah, absolutely. Well, he was a former boyfriend of Princess Margaret.
No, I'll tell you this story.
Is that all made up?
No, it's not even made up. The story is, Di Llewellyn, they were he and Roddy, and Roddy was the boyfriend of Princess Margaret.
Right, Roddy right. Okay,
he was a gardener.
He was the guy, yeah.
And he was a gardener. Mm. What happened was that Di and Roddy were the sons of Colonel Llewellyn, who was an Olympic-winning gold medalist in equestrian.
Equestrian events,
That's right. So they should have been the star sons of the family.
Yeah.
But in fact, Roddy became a gardener. Di just became a layabout.
Right.
He was known as Seducer of the Valleys, Di Llewellyn.
Right.
And he'd go around, you know, sort of...
And he'd live in some kind of horrendous rental apartment in Soho or something?
Well, no, I think he lived in quite a nice place on Park Lane, but it was all family property.
Right.
He just didn't have any money himself.
He didn't have a job.
He had a family trust, you know, of a few bob, and he had a family apartment that he lived in.
Right.
But he ended up doing things like being the front man for every new nightclub that opened in London.
Yeah.
But he was always giving the diary stories.
He was a sort of early version of the Cad, wasn't he? Really?
Yeah, he was, yeah, he
Princess
was, yeah.
Diana's former captain boyfriend.
That's right.
Hewitt.
That's right. So when he wasn't earning money from, you know, diarists and all that, he would appear in the News of the World with preposterous TV adverts like, "My name is Di Llewellyn. You may think that I've been outshone by my brother Roddy because he's been close to Princess Margaret. Let me tell you, I have kept my name, you know, my name in society, because I am truly a baronet and heir to my father's baronetcy."
So, will he be doing adverts for the News of the World like to say, "I come in this weekend, you know, I'm going to be telling you my secrets
about
the royal family"?
I'll be telling you all about my brother Roddy. So they were selling secrets on each other.
It's a bit like Diana's, do you remember Diana's mother? Or was it Diana's, it wasn't Rain Spencer, but the one that lived in Scotland?
Yeah, she was always intoxicated.
And even when I was still working in news way back when, when Diana was still alive,
he
just sent somebody round to the house in the afternoon, and she'd be so sozzled that she'd invite them in and tell them anything.
Francis Shan Kidd,
that's her.
Well, when I was executive of the Press Association, and there was a quiet night, the phone would ring about 10 to 12, and this mad, you know, intoxicated woman would be on the other end of the phone telling us she was Diana's mother.
Yeah, yeah.
And eventually,
you'd be going, "Who's this nutter on the phone? Get rid of her.
Exactly.
Don't bother talking to her. Don't entertain her.
Well,
you know."
Well, she would appear in the diary columns all the time as well.
Right.
But
also, the other thing about the diary guys is that they were always quite good at hanging around with some of the news guys. Like, Ross Benson was always very smart about hanging around with some of the news reporters, because they'd always tell him stuff
exactly,
that they couldn't put in their own stories.
No, that's right.
Or you'd know something as the news desk supremo.
True.
You could pass on to him, you know.
True, absolutely right. Mm. He was exceptional, Ross, because not only was a diarist, he took the mickey out of himself, you know, and wore fantastic clothes and all that. But he was broke all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
A, because he was paying off a divorce.
Well, because he was constantly shagging around, wasn't he?
He was shagging around. He was paying off some divorce. Mm. He had a very expensive taste. So when he mixed with George Best at Annabelle's and the champagne was 250 quid a bottle in those days,
right,
you know, old Ross had to shell out for that because George Best didn't pay for anything.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Right.
If you want to take George Best out, you paid, you know?
Yeah.
So he was constantly broke. But he was so charming, he would go to the editor and say, "Nick, you know, I have a great idea for a new book I'm writing." Nick said, "Oh, that's very nice, Ross. Yeah, go and write your book. Yeah, yeah, I thought you might like to buy the serialisation of it." "Would I? Well, it would help me out, Nick. I need about 40 grand.
Yeah.
So Nick then, you know, would buy the book. They then serialise it. It didn't have one new fact in it. It was just a load of cut-ins. And Ross had hired
some
kid
like
to get
sort of
all the cut-ins out the pencil and knock it out.
Yeah.
You know,
but also, one, he was a great writer. Two, he had a super nose for news. And actually, you could make it look like it was new.
Yeah.
And then the newspaper could sell it off the top of the banner and all that.
Yeah.
And it was a win-win for everyone, really.
It certainly was. Now, the other guy I'm going to tell you, that was a diarist, was Peter Tory.
Yes.
Now,
I remember Peter Tory. When I was made, acting features editor of the Daily Express, Peter Tory was one of the people who first came to me and asked me to go out for lunch. so yeah. that we could discuss the future.
Yeah, that's right. You know. A pay rise.
One, a pay rise. Two, whether he could work slightly less.
Yes.
And three, whether or not he could do more sort of general feature writing
yeah.
rather than just writing his column.
Yes, that's
because
right.
Because he wanted
yeah.
to write any old cobblers that he fancied writing about.
I know, but he wanted to get paid extra for it as well.
Oh, yeah,
and all
yeah.
that kind of. He ended up on the Daily Star, by the way, because when they split the staffs of the Express and the Star to try and make the Star a reasonably decent newspaper,
yeah.
they took some good people with them.
Yes.
But they got more money for going there, and that yeah. was the thing. Mm. But Peter, he's very
I never understood
guy.
His column, actually. Because he wrote a column latterly in the Daily Express, well, you know, when he wasn't doing the diary.
No, he did.
And I never understood it.
Yeah, but nobody did, because by that time he'd become a manic depressive. Mm. And he used to write about the black dog.
No, but he also used to write about all these characters that were sort of either figments of his imagination,
yes.
but who would pop up again from time to time.
Yes, that's
in
right.
In different
yeah.
situations.
Yeah,
but you kind of go, well, you don't know who these people are.
No, but that was part of his, you know, he used to about once every sort of week or once every 10 days
yeah.
he'd write about, you know, the sheer terror of depression.
Well, I mean, because he did genuinely suffer
yeah,
from it.
He did, he did. And a lot of sympathy for him and all that, but it got him into strange moods. But the other thing he liked doing was flying Spitfires.
Yes.
And he was one of the first blokes I know to manage to bag himself a seat in the Spitfire.
Yeah.
You know, to go flying around, that kind of stuff.
Right.
He was a true, you know, English gentleman and all that. But all these guys were great to get into a pub for a few drinks and all that kind of stuff. And they'd tell you, even they would tell you stories they couldn't even put in their
yes,
diary.
Absolutely.
And to explain to our listeners, the beauty of a diary is that you can get away with putting things in there because you...
Well,
the way
it's
you
gossip,
heard it,
isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. The way you heard it is you say, you know, according to rumour yeah. at Kensington Palace,
yes.
you know, but you know, nobody's standing this up and the butler says and all this kind of
well,
stuff.
Well, also, yeah, the style of it was yeah. very much sort of tongue-in-cheek, an awful lot
yeah,
of it.
Exactly.
And you could get away, as you say, with an awful lot more. His other yeah. claims to fame, of course, was that he'd been to stage school and he'd been to stage school at the same time as Julie Christie.
That's right.
With whom he had had an affair.
Yeah.
And he was literally one of those guys who, more or less everybody, I think, who ever had known or come across him knew that he had done it. Because he'd tell you within about the first 10 minutes of talking to you.
Yeah, that's right,
he'd say,
yeah.
by the way, I don't like to talk about
no,
this.
No, about me and Julie
Christie. But you do know that Julie yeah. Christie and I were lovers.
Yes.
You know, and it didn't really count.
But, no,
well, it
no.
did count, but, I mean, they were very young.
Yes.
And she hadn't become a megastar.
No.
And she hadn't been in Shampoo or anything like that.
No, that's
you
right.
Know, some of these great movies that she was in.
No, that's
but,
right.
I mean, he would always volunteer that within the first 5 or 10
yeah,
minutes.
I know. Yeah, he was quite an interesting guy.
Yeah.
There was the other diarist who always amused me.
Yeah.
Was our little fat friend from the Mirror.
Paul Callan. Well, funnily enough, I spent a very bizarre weekend once
in
when I was editor of, I think it was the Welsh Mirror.
Yes.
Or it might have been when I was at the Express. I can't remember. One of in fact, it was probably the Express because I got invited because Callan and Tory were both on the Express.
Yes, that's
and
right.
And they were kind of vying
for... Was Callan
for...
on the Express?
He was on
I always
Express,
knew
yeah.
when he was on the Mirror.
Yeah. No, he came. He moved. He got. I think he got finally laid off from the Mirror and
right,
he joined
okay,
the Express.
Yeah.
And because he famously got the number of pallbearers wrong at Diana's funeral because he was sent down to write the colour.
Yeah.
But like all the colour pieces he ever wrote, he used to write them before anything happened.
Sure,
and he'd go in the pub.
Yeah.
And he would just say, oh, dear boy. And I mean, he used to get quite a lot wrong, but getting that bit wrong, because, I mean, there was so much. I mean, you remember the Diana's funeral, right?
Yes, that's right.
I mean, it was wall to wall.
Yeah.
You know, we were doing the whole paper on it.
That's right.
We Callum's copy drops.
Yeah.
And we went, well, hang on a second.
That's not
six
right.
of them, isn't it?
Yeah.
And he put something like there was four. I mean, completely wrong.
That's
and
right.
everyone's watching on television around the world, you know.
Yeah.
But anyway, he invited me to his little house in Oxfordshire.
Right.
In the Cotswolds.
Mm-hmm.
And then he invited Peter Tory and his wife round for dinner.
All right, yeah.
So there was Callan and his wife, Peter Tory and his wife, and me and my wife at the time. And it was one of those very drunken evenings. I have no idea how it ended. I have no idea whether somebody stormed out or not.
Yeah.
But he lived in his tiny little cottage.
Yeah.
I expected his big
Why
collection.
Did he live in a tiny cottage?
Well, it was his country home.
Oh, it was his second home.
Yeah,
oh,
but he talks about it like it was this great manoir.
I see.
And actually, it was like a sort of workman's cottage.
Was it a terrace cottage?
I don't. Yeah,
it was squashed between two other houses.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
And it was in one of those places like Lower Slaughter, you know, where people looked in the windows.
Yeah, that's right.
And I just remember being very, it was a very bizarre night, you know,
all
in all.
Yeah, sure. Sure, very odd indeed.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, I was there when William Hickey, as you quite rightly say, which is a fictitious guy from the
1700s. Who's been killed off now, hasn't he?
Well, I was about to say, he's been resurrected, actually.
Oh,
he's resurrected in recent years, but I was there when they first killed him off.
Right.
Now, Nick Lloyd came to the paper.
Sir Nicholas,
and he was determined to revolutionise the Daily Express,
right.
And the first thing he did was introduce a colour magazine in the middle, which was being edited by his wife, Eve Pollard, and it was, you know, it was glossy and had soup.
The old ones are the best ones.
Yeah, that's right. right, yeah.
Yeah, I've got a great idea. Yeah. Here's a new magazine. My wife will edit it,
that's
and
right,
then we'll all make some more money.
Yeah, exactly. but it was to try and rival the style and the panache of the Daily Mail, you see.
Yes,
so,
of course.
So that's what we're doing. Mm. And the second thing he decided to do was he said, we're going to get rid of William Hickey. And it was a terrible mistake in my view.
Yeah.
But how could you say that when you're an up-and-coming news editor?
Well, particularly when you're like such a lick spit.
Yeah, exactly.
Went,
of course,
good idea. Fantastic. Yeah, but there was so much of that, wasn't there?
Yeah.
I mean, you were mentioning earlier when we were talking about Alan Frame.
Mm.
Alan Frame was the absolute master of lick spittling.
He was.
I mean, this is a guy who, whenever the editor said something, just immediately said, yes, Nicholas, that's a fantastic, a bang the table. What a great idea.
Yeah.
I mean, he could have been outside 5 minutes earlier telling us all what an absolute wanker he thought the editor was.
Let me tell you, it was fantastic. Let me just tell you first about William Hickey going, because what happened was he announced, brilliant idea, Nick. So then all the people who'd worked on Hickey, including Dempster, by the way, worked on Hickey before he ran across the road to the Daily Mail, and Geoffrey Levy, remember
Geoffrey Levy,
they decided to have a funeral in Fleet Street for William Hickey.
Complete
with a coffin,
stopped
all the traffic. They told the police what they're doing, the police stopped the traffic, they had a coffin, absolutely right, walked it from the City Golf Club, which was the only all-day drinking club in Fleet Street in those days, up to Fleet Street. They all wear Paul Bearer stuff. Yeah. Problem was, Geoffrey Levy was only 5'2".
Right.
And all the rest, like Ross Benson and Nigel Dempster, were all 6'1".
Right.
So it's a pathetic thing of where they're resting on Geoffrey Levy's top hat.
Yeah.
You know?
I seem to remember, was it not also, when you saw the pictures, was it not sort of tilted terribly
down
at one
end
because of Levy?
Geoffrey was
tilted. Where did they take it in the end then?
Oh, I've no idea. Probably took it to St Bride's, I would imagine, which is the journalist church, and just threw it in the old graveyard.
Yeah,
got into the pub across, which was another one that was the only one open. But Alan Frame was a number. He was a great guy because I used to love the audacity with which his treachery was always so apparent, you know. And on one occasion, we went for what we call a think, because the reason we're talking Alan Frame
actually,
is...
Actually, we should do a special episode on think tanks.
Definitely, we do think tanks. But Alan Frame was in charge of the diary section of the Express, you know, we edited it and all this kind of stuff, you know, no matter who was the actual, you know, William Hickey at the time. So, but we had a think tank and Frame came in. Anyway, we always went to these think tanks for some unknown reason on a Sunday afternoon. And everybody got absolutely battered in drink on Sunday night. And then we were all supposed to go up Monday morning.
But you stayed the night, presumably, right?
He stayed for 3 nights.
Okay,
No, 2 nights. He stayed Sunday night, stayed Monday night, and came on Tuesday. Supposed to be working all day Monday, all day Tuesday, and then a farewell dinner on Tuesday night, and then leaves Monday. But every night was a farewell dinner. The Duke one time got the night porter out of bed to open the cabinet with the champagne, because we'd run out.
This is the Duke being the picture editor.
Yeah, the picture editor of the Express.
Christy Kanovich.
But on this particular first night, Sunday night, it's amazing. Old Frame, you know, goes completely mad on the drink as always, you know, because it's all free, of course, you know, and that's all great. And then the next morning, you know, I mean, I had great resilience in those days. I could drink all night, still get up. Can't do it now, I admit, because only one third of my heart works.
I've heard
but
that,
in those
yeah.
days, the whole of my heart worked.
Yeah.
And I would laugh at all these people struggling to get into, you know, the start of the
and all looking
morning
terribly
session, looking terribly off-faced at 10:30. But anyway,
well, to be fair, that's because you were doing it every night.
Yeah,
anyway,
well, that's true. Yeah,
it's a bit like going out on New Year's Eve and watching all the drunks, where you go, "Well, hang on, what's so special about tonight?"
It's true. I was very practiced at it. Yeah. But anyway, so on the first morning, and I hadn't spoken to anybody else about what they were doing. Uh-huh. I think, you know, to introduce a load of stupid ideas, which nobody ever acted on or anything. It was just an excuse. I mean, the editor spent most of the time playing golf anyway.
Yeah. Well, it was an excuse for him to get everybody to pay him a load of compliments.
Yeah, that's right.
Well
done,
Sir Nicholas.
Brilliant, Sir Nicholas. So anyway, on day one, Nick says, and Nick wasn't that excessive, to be honest. I mean, he thought he was, but he wasn't a big drinker.
No.
So he said, right, OK, we're going to get started. Right, now, who's kicking off? Oh, yeah, Alan. Now, where's Alan? Oh, where's Alan? Anyway, Frame had got so deep into the drink, he couldn't get up.
Really?
He couldn't get up.
Dear
and
God.
And the irony of the whole thing was he was introducing the new section, which it was his idea, which he designed, and he laid out all the pages, and he was going to produce it to us.
Yeah.
And it was called Health and Fitness.
Oh, yeah.
But he couldn't get out of bed to deliver it because he was so unhealthy and unfit.
Unbelievable. Funny enough, he was very... studious-looking man, wasn't he? Because he had a very white, a very prematurely white hair.
Yes.
And a white beard.
White beard, that's right,
And he spoke terribly well. And he seemed to me...
I clocked
it pretty early on when I got back to work for the Express. That here's a guy who's a complete bullshitter.
Yeah, that's right.
Absolute and
Completely.
Bullshitter.
Completely.
And, you know, would be quite happy just standing on the back bench and saying, no, to Terry Manners. You know, look, Terry, I really think that, you know, that's the wrong... page one, you know, you should go with this. And then Nick Lloyd would appear and say, oh, that's great, Terry. So, absolutely fantastic. Yeah, brilliant. Terry. But he once had a massive public row with Paul Callan, funnily enough, because Callan was the colour guy.
Yes.
And there was a royal trip to Nepal or something, right? Mm. And Robert Jobson had just been hired as the royal correspondent.
Oh, who was, what,
you know,
the Express?
Yeah, he was at the Express. And he'd come over from, I think, the Sun.
Yeah.
It was when Ian Walker was there, you know.
Yes.
And he'd come over, I think, from the Sun and very highly respected royal man. Had lots of great contacts. Of course, Callan had no contacts because he was another bullshitter, right?
Yeah.
And so Jobson had been picked to go to Nepal, and Callan had found out and was absolutely raging. He came back from the pub this day and was like, "That's a fucking disgrace, you know. I should be going on that fucking plane, you know."
Who's this? Callan.
This was Callan, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Anyway, so so old Frame, who had made this decision, got wind of this, right, and came out rather foolishly. And Callan was sitting in where the reporters all used to be. And said, "Look, Paul, I'm sorry, but, you know, we need to talk about this. I can't have you, like, effing and blinding on the floor, you know, complaining."
Everybody else
Because
does,
I think
he
said, you know, I think that C-word, you know, Frame has done this, you know.
Yeah.
And and he just said, "Oh, you can fuck off. I'm not talking to you." And we were all sitting there pissing ourselves laughing because Frame was the executive editor. You know, he was quite an important man. And Callan just refused to pay him any mention, wouldn't speak to him.
No.
"I'm not interested in you." You know, jumped up. And he started just really insulting him. Jumped up, you know, you think you're an executive, bloody useless.
Yeah,
you know, it was brilliant.
Office boy.
It was absolutely brilliant. You know.
Well, yeah, but he got he fell foul of his own Machiavellian ways.
Yeah.
Because I get back from some foreign trip one time, and you know, got in, nobody in the office. You know, I don't know where I'd been. It doesn't matter. But you know, you got back, you dropped your luggage off, and all kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And I thought everyone must be in the pub, so I got on the popping chair. Anyway, old Frame is holding court in the corner. Oh, fantastic! Life's ambition achieved and all that. Oh, what's going on? Oh, Mike, great! Did a fantastic job in Libya or wherever I'd been. You know,
yeah,
fantastic. He says, "I'll be after you." You know, I said, "Why? What's happened?" He said, "I've just made the editor of the Daily of the Sunday Express." I said, "Alan, that's fantastic."
Another one.
Yeah. I've just been made the editor. I said, "I can't. I've just seen the chairman and all this kind of stuff." You know. I said, "That's fantastic." I said, "Well done." I said, you know, I didn't even hear anything about it. No, okay, out of the blue. I'm absolutely delighted. And, you know, wink, and all this. He's been on the cards for a couple of months. But didn't want to say anything. But let's get some more champagne in. Anyway, after about half an hour, we're aware of the fact that at the other end of the popping jay, around the corner, there seems to be another celebration going on.
Right.
And I said to Ollis, "Oh, what's going on over there?" He said, "Oh, I don't know, you know, losers and all this kind of stuff." Anyway, I wandered over because another load of colleagues over there, executives.
Uh-huh.
It was, I've forgotten his name now, but he... Anyway, the point is, that whoever it was...
Whoever had actually been appointed.
It was celebrating being made the editor of the Sunday Express. So, and do you remember who it was?
Was it not Robin Morgan again, the guy you
No, it was the other Robin. He ended up at the Mail. It was Robin.
Robin Esser.
Robin Esser, thank you.
Okay.
And Robin was even smoother than Alan, you know. And I said, "Hi, Robin." I said, "What are you up to?" He said, "Haven't you heard?" I said, "No." He said, and he was much less enthusiastic about life than Alan Frame. He said, "No, I've just been appointed over the Sunday." I said, "Are you sure?"
Did you tell him Alan Frame thought
he
had?
Yeah, I said, he said, "Oh," he said, "oh, there's been a bit of a misunderstanding." I said, "Well, who is?" He said, "No, it is me." He said, "Alan was appointed, but they've unappointed him and given it to me." I said, "He doesn't seem to know. Seriously." So I am back.
I mean,
I said,
"Al." There's many situations in newspapers where nobody ever knew what was going on.
No, I said, "Al." I said, I tapped you on the shoulder. "Yes, what is it, Michael? Great to see you. Great job in Libya." You know, I said, "Yeah." I said, "Look," I said, "I don't want to worry you." I said, "But Robin Esther's round the corner there with a load of people who actually are more important than the people here in your group."
Yeah.
Like deputy editors. Right. And he says he's been made the Sunday... Ludicrous. Don't be so fucking ridiculous. Yeah. Goes round, comes back crestfallen. And in fact, he had been appointed and unappointed in the space of about half an hour.
Really?
Well, he'd been appointed on Frame.
What, by Stevens? Lord
by
Stevens.
Lord Stevens. Yeah. By Lord Stevens, the chairman of the company.
Yeah.
Robin Esser stormed into the office when he heard about this, you know, heard about Alan Frame's celebration party downstairs.
Yeah.
said that, you know, this is outrageous, you know, the promise was mine, it's always my job, all this kind of stuff, and I'm leaving the company immediately, and, you know, yeah. Lord, what was his name again?
Stevens.
Stevens didn't want this. He said, no, don't worry. He said, I can assure you, Robin, it's your job. I'll talk to Alan.
Yeah.
But then he couldn't find Alan because there's no mobile phones in those days.
Yeah,
he was in the pub.
So
Robin goes into the same pub. He says, I'm the Alan Frame was crestfallen,
yeah.
Utterly and absolutely crestfallen, but he'd never threatened to walk out if he didn't get the job, so he wasn't going to lose a top executive.
It was hopeless. I mean, when they made me, when I was a reporter, when I first got back from America, I think they called it acting features editor, because they wanted to get rid of this woman called Heather McGlone, who was very neurotic and was driving everybody mad.
Yes.
And they wanted to, and of course, their way of doing that was to promote her into associate editor, to give her your old office up by the end of the building.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
And, anyway, so I walked round the morning of the day after I'd been appointed to see Roger Watkins and that guy Steve Martin.
Yeah.
And that little guy who was always been accused of sexual harassment.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
And it turned out that they had no idea. Nobody had told them.
No.
So I walked around there and I said, hi, guys. Because Paul Potts had said, you'll make sure Mike Graham goes around and takes that position.
Yeah.
So I went round there and said to these two guys, I said, hi, guys. They said, would you be surprised to see me round here today? And they went, oh, it's always nice to see you news guys around here. You've got a couple of ideas for us.
Yeah.
I said, yeah, here's an idea for you. I'm your new fucking boss.
Yeah.
What do you make of that? And they both stood up and sort of almost saluted me.
Right. Okay.
And then from that point on, did everything that they could to undermine me for as long as I was there.
Well, that was the way Fleet Street worked, wasn't it?
Shocking.
There was.
Anyway, we're probably out of time, you know.
Well, let me just say, there was sadly a colleague, right? And, and there's nothing funny about this, but his name is Philip Geddes.
Yes.
He was a young fella. He came out of Oxford University and he desperately wanted to be a journalist and more particularly a diarist.
Yeah.
And he was a sharp and snappy fella. I was the news editor. I think I was deputy news editor. I used to have a few clashes with him saying, you know, you shouldn't take stories like that and put them in your diary and all that kind of stuff. Nevertheless, I was in America one time when Harrods blew up, when the IRA blew up Harrods.
Yes.
And I was saddened, terribly saddened, to find that Philip Geddes was killed in that blast.
Yeah.
It was shocking because he was the only son of two immigrant Poles who set up a tailor's business in Barrow-in-Furness, not the most exotic place in Britain.
Yeah.
And he went to Oxford University, did he? He was a lovely lad. But the strangest thing about all this was, and this was probably through his work as a diarist, when they went to his apartment after he died and had to clear everything, they found messages on his answer phone from Valerie Singleton, who was an awful lot older than him, you know, but still a very glamorous TV presenter.
Right.
And you assume that that was in the course of his business, like we just said.
Mm.
He was mixing with everybody.
Yeah.
But it was terribly sad.
Very sad. Mm. But fascinating times, fascinating stories. We'll have loads more of them when we come back to you with the next episode of On the Record. Callan had no contacts because he was another bullshitter, right?
Yeah.
And so Jobson had been picked to go to Nepal, and Callan had found out and was absolutely raging. He came back from the pub this day and was like, that's a fucking disgrace, you know, I should be going on that fucking plane, you know.
This was Callan,
right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Anyway, so old Frame, who had made this decision, got wind of this, right, and came out rather foolishly. And Callan was sitting in where the reporters all used to be. And said, look, Paul, I'm sorry, but, you know, we need to talk about it. I can't have you, like, effing and blinding on the floor, you know, complaining.
Everybody
because
else
I
does,
think
yeah.
he said, you know, C-word, you know, Frame has done this, you know.
Yeah.
And and he just said, oh, you can fuck off. I'm not talking to you. And we were all sitting there pissing ourselves laughing because Frame was the executive editor. You know, he was quite an important man. And Callan just refused to pay him any mention, wouldn't speak to him.
No.
I'm not interested in you. You know, jumped up. And he started just really insulting
him.
Jumped up, you know, you think you're an executive, bloody useless. Yeah, you know, it was brilliant.
Office boy,
it was absolutely brilliant.
When his member was erect, he could actually put six half-pint beer jugs.
No.
One on top of the other with the handles.
I was going to say, hopefully not one next to each other.
No, with the handles hanging off his member.
Really?
And walk around the room.
No.
Yes.
That's very long.
That was his
really?
Party trick. Yeah, that's what he could do.
Blimey. Yeah. Sure, he wasn't a demi-tasse.
No. And that was what he's famous for. I said, I don't want to worry you. I said, but Robin Esther's round the corner there with a load of people who actually are more important than the people here in your group,
yeah,
like deputy editors, right, and that. And right, he says he's been made under something ludicrous. Don't be so fucking ridiculous. Yeah. Goes round, comes back crestfallen.
Yeah, yeah.
And in fact, he had been appointed and unappointed, right, in the space of about half an hour.
Really?